Who's the other host?
Unity is strength. We got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now it's time to do the right thing.
We need more UNITY.
Cool. Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now it's time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and the
right
fighting.
Now, right now.
Now it's time to do the right thing. Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right.
Right now.
That's right, that's right. We are going to do it right. This is Jamal Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And we are live here at Black Radio Hall of Fame. Any opinions expressed on this show are those of the host and not necessarily those of Harrisville State University or BRHF. But there are going to be plenty of opinions, so get ready. And I have some hosts here who have been doing it right for a long time. These are my comrades in struggle. I'm honored to introduce David Makanwal and Kay Ochi, who are very active in Japanese American issues, social justice issues. And because we are days away from the infamous bombing, the atomic bomb on the two cities in Japan, this is an opportune time, we believe, to talk about not just those situations, but we also want to talk about the long history of Asian and Black solidarity in this country, which sometimes, you know, gets buried based on some of the anti-Asian and even some of the anti-Black sentiments that gets, you know, fomented by the common enemies. I'm just going to leave it like that. So, David and Kay, welcome to the show.
Hello, hello. Thank you very much, Jamala.
Hi, Jamala. Thanks so much for letting us speak.
Yeah, no problem. It's important that you be here. So, David is... As I said, these folks got a long history of community activism. Both at some point were chairs of the Nikkei for Civil Rights and Redress. And I think, Kay, you currently are the president of the Japanese American Historical Society of San Diego, right?
Right.
Okay.
This is my retirement, definitely.
Yeah. And... David, you've been working with, you know, elders, Asian elders around healthcare. You're part of our Save Our Seniors Network. But you also are part of the Little Tokyo Against Gentrification. And I really want to hit that first. And I'm saying that only because just recently there was a piece on National Public Radio about this. And there was a young sister talking about the work that's being done there to stop the gentrification. This is a community that's over 100 years old. So talk about what's going on with Little Tokyo and why it is now a target of gentrification.
It's been a target of gentrification since the 70s and 80s. And the first round had to do with evicting many of the working class residents, mom-and-pop shops, and cultural center, cultural institutions in Little Tokyo. And in its place, luxury hotels and, you know, tourist-oriented businesses began to spring up. We were able to get some concessions from that, like, you know, public housing, but this gentrification has continued in Little Tokyo, as it has all over. And currently, we're trying to fight a large mega development called Fourth and Central Development. And it's a one-block, 10-building mega project, which will completely change the face of Little Tokyo. So we're trying to get, you know, more affordable housing and community spaces and you know, assurances against pollution from the construction. So that's what we're working on right now.
Wow. And I know there's been all kind of evictions, closures, relocations, because they really, really want that prime real estate. But I'm wondering, as part of the struggle, that these Little Tokyo's obviously is somebody's ward and district. Have those elected officials been complicit with the developers? How is that working?
Yeah, we're finding that they are. One council person who is the person elected official for Little Tokyo, his name is Kevin De Leon. He made national headlines because of a leaked phone call exposing the racism that these council people were operating with. And, there was a national call. In fact, Biden called for him to step down. And so many of the council people did step down because they were caught in this leaked phone call where they're discussing racist power grabs throughout the city.
Wow. So it's pretty transparent what the plan is. It's just a matter of now organizing against it, right? Right.
Yeah. But they all have, they have their cronies and friends in city government and throughout the community. So it's not that simple.
Yeah. So I just want to give an overview of, Asian, Black histories, because again, as I said, I think it gets buried in many cases. And I think particularly for those in the Midwest and not on the East and West Coast, there has rarely been interaction with Asian folks of Asian descent. And so I'd have to say most of what people know is from the TV. And, and sometimes those toxic views get inhaled by folks who, you'd hope would know better. But a lot of times once they're educated, then they understand that we were always, faced with common enemies. And one of the things I wrote about, I did a column for the Black Commentator that was picked up by East Wind and other publications, because it was at a time when that salon in Atlanta was targeted, and six of those people were of Asian descent, and so there was all this talk about whoa, and I'm like, well, wait a minute now, let's know the history here. We got a history. There is a history. You may not know it, but there is a history, because I started hearing stuff like, well, why should we support them? They don't support us. Not true. And so part of my article then went to talk about, this history goes back to the 1700s, when some of the Chinese and Filipino slaves, Filipino workers and African slaves were, hooked up in the Louisiana swamps. Those are the Black Maroons. And then we have the whole history of Blacks and Chinese working in the Louisiana sugar canes. Mm-hmm. There was always this interaction as workers. And then, as we start to evolve and those struggles started kicking off in the 50s and 60s, the second generation of Asian Americans definitely were part of the social justice movement. And in fact, that's how I met a lot of folks then. And then you have, folks like in Detroit. We didn't have this person in our Detroit, but Grace Boggs. So there were people that some folks knew, but in places I can tell you, like St. Louis, we didn't have that. And so there was mostly Asians in our community that were establishing business. And so there was a transactional relationship, and that's all people knew. And then, of course, the most negative came from Korean shop owners who were somehow, for whatever reason, more hostile. And so you had these clashes. But, there is a long history. It's complicated, but it's long. And so the article's name was "No Vietnamese Ever Called Me Nigger." And we know that that's from, Muhammad Ali refusal to participate by saying that. And so that elevated that whole solidarity, thank goodness, with Asian people, particularly with Vietnamese struggling for self-determination. So I'm just giving that overarching view, because I think it gets lost, obviously, and sometimes intentionally, in the history. But I want us to talk about, the concentration camps of Japanese Americans first, and then talk about the atomic bomb. And I know that is that's coming up, because for people who don't really pay attention to history, most will think that the concentration or the roundup of Japanese Americans came after the atomic bomb and not before. And so there is a few years differences in those two happenings. So I'd really like you to talk about what happened when President Roosevelt, President of these United States, issued the executive order 9066 that says all Japanese people were going to be rounded up and placed in American concentration camps. And both of you all have parents that were part of this whole thing. So I really would love to hear. I know there was a silent, just like for whatever reason, folks who are descendants of slavery were silent because somehow they thought it was their fault that they were enslaved. But that's how these folks could twist your psyche to think that somehow you had control over what happened. And I know that your parents and even some of the survivors and the testimonies that you all have heard, people, there was just so much shame that people just didn't even want to talk about it, even to their own family.
Right.
Yeah, so talk about that.
Yeah, Jamala, this is the big topic of my entire life, I believe, because so much of our history was denied and buried by the way it was, you know, recorded and not recorded by, you know, education, the government, etc. So I grew up, you know, not knowing anything about our own community's history. So one of the main points of my involvement is first that my mom and dad were incarcerated. By the way, I'm calling, participating from San Diego, California. This is where my mom and dad were born and raised. I'm sorry, born. And they, like a certain segment of Japanese Americans, were actually raised in Japan because their immigrant parents couldn't afford daycare. Okay, so they were actually shipped back to Japan, stayed there till the end of the 1930s. So they came back very, you know, dominantly Japanese cultured and speaking Japanese primarily. So their experience amongst the Japanese American community is a little bit different. But all that goes to say they were kicked out of San Diego, forced to go to Santa Anita Racetrack, put in the horse stalls, and until the U.S. government could get their act together and build those, you know, incarceration camps. And so, you know, 3-4 months after they had been in Santa Anita, they were moved out to Poston, Arizona, which is a real hellhole of a desert land with, you know, and kind of just such, you know, a drastic change from where they had lived for most of their lives. And they had to suffer that for, you know, 3 years for no reason other than the color of their skin, their racial ancestry. So I think that there's a lot to say about FDR. I do want to just say that EO 9066, for whatever reason, didn't target Japanese Americans solely, but what it did is authorize the military to do whatever necessary to protect, you know, the coast. And it was General DeWitt, who really is one of our arch enemies. You can Google his name. And he said horrible things like, "A Jap's a Jap and always will be, even if they're, you know, born here." He said so many heinous things, but he really, you know, he echoed a lot of the political leaders in California. This has been since the late 1800s in California, when Japanese worked alongside of the Chinese railroad workers, alongside the white railroad workers. But if you recall the historic photo at Promontory Point where they, you know, pound in the golden spike, etc., there was not an Asian in sight. They were all shunted to the back of the scene, you know. Mm. This is just repeated and repeated throughout history. However, going back to sort of the experience, it really was based, you know, I'm going to fast forward to a commission. The commission in 1981 that the government did authorize came to Los Angeles. And this is in 1981, and we're talking so many years after the war. And, you know, I had settled into suburbia and become a housewife, et cetera, et cetera. Well, this shook me to my roots because it was not until 81 that we really started to learn the real story of what happened to Japanese Americans. And it was tragic. There were tears. There was anger. There was fist pounding. It was shocking what we learned through the testimonies of regular Japanese Americans who step forward to speak to this commission and tell the true story of what happened to Japanese Americans. And that single event got me on this trajectory. I think David may have started a lot earlier, but it's been, you know, 40 plus years, and David, we're 40 plus years older, but we're still at it, and because it lit the fire in our belly, and, you know, there's no turning back from what the government and the racist actions of leaders, you know, before the war and throughout the war and even after the war.
Exactly.
And we had very little support. No one said, hey, wait a minute, you can't be doing this.
Right, right.
I have to acknowledge one group did stand up for us, and those were the Quakers. To this day, Jamala, I give those Quakers, American friends, a little bit of money each month because they continue to do fabulous work all over the world for people who need that help. So I've got to do a shout out. But I do want to spend a quick minute and talk about solidarity with Black Americans. I was born and raised in Logan Heights in San Diego, which was then and still remains a very African American, Latino, Mexican, new immigrant community. My first elementary school was Luther Burbank. I believe that it's very common. Japanese lived in very diverse and mostly Black communities in San Diego because of the racial the redlining, the restrictive covenants. We couldn't live anywhere else. And also we couldn't afford anywhere else. I think it started there, but even I'm going to fast forward to the redress movement. We had NCRR, the group that David and I both started the redress, worked with the redress campaign in, was really supported hugely by Congressman Mervyn Dimoli out of the Gardena-Compton area of L.A. He was one of our main just advocates and helped us take it to Congress. I have to shout out to Representative Ron Dellums. He spoke an impassioned speech on the House floor in favor of the redress bill. The Black Congressional Caucus, you know, folks like Augustus Hawkins, Yvonne Braithwaite-Burk. More and more, and I must shout out to Reverend Jesse Jackson, because during his presidential campaign, he even gave a shout out to JA Reparations. There's so much more about JA and Black solidarity. It would take hours, really, to talk about it. In fact, books have, you know, been written.
And documentaries made.
It's a beautiful thing. And, you know, and that's why those of us who understand our history, our own history, are supporting Black reparations. We're to this day, you know, continuing to learn about Black history and all the different actions going on all over the country today. But I don't want to get
and we're going to cover that in a minute. We want to hear from David. What was your recollections of any kind of discussion in the household about the concentration camps? And I know that our dear friend George Takei says, do not call it internment. And I really never have. I always called them concentration camps because that's what they were. But internment seems to be a more sanitized word that people want to use. But it is, in fact, a concentration camp. People were held there against their will. So what is your recollection of the family discussion about that? And when did you first get wind of, wait a minute, this went down and I didn't know about it?
Unlike Kay, my parents immigrated here in 1957. I was born in Japan, actually, and I immigrated here. So they were not in camp. My father was a U.S. Army soldier stationed in Japan during the occupation to suppress and Americanize the Japanese civilian population. He took part in that, but he was never a part of, you know, being in the camps. Now, his dad was, because they were in Hawaii. That's a whole different story how that went down in Hawaii. But getting back to your point, the Japanese families were so traumatized that by and large, this is not every single family, but the overwhelming majority of families, the parents did not talk about the camps. So it's one big secret. Mm-hmm. So we kids, we'd be talking, you know, like going to school, high school, whatever, and we're talking about, oh, you know, if somebody brought up the camps, everybody go, oh, yeah, I know. Yeah, they don't talk about it. Yeah, and you too? Yeah, me too. Your dad too? Yeah, my dad too. So if you can imagine, although the crime was not as heinous and far spread as slavery. If you can imagine an entire generation, okay, of African Americans who refused to tell their sons and daughters about slavery, and all the sons and daughters wandering throughout their whole lives, what was the secret that my parents were holding? That's what it was like growing up in a Japanese American family. And I first found out when I was organizing and working in a mental health institution, a mental health facility called Rest Haven, which held many, many former survivors of the camps who heard voices, who were psychotic and all kinds of things. And it was through experiencing that that I first learned about what happened in the camps and the impact that it had on Japanese Americans, which still lasts to today.
Wow. That's incredible. And you mentioned Hawaii. This is what was a bit confusing to me when I heard about the Hawaiian experience, because they, apparently the order did not apply to Hawaii. And I'm thinking, well, what is this, some kind of selective, who gets to be a patriot? So the folks that were there joined, what was it, the 442nd Regiment, and these folks served in Europe. Nothing really happened to them. What was that all about?
Yeah, well, I can
go ahead.
Well, I'll just say that Hawaii had too many Japanese Americans. The population was huge. Therefore, they couldn't remove the Japanese Americans because the economy would collapse. And it was economic.
Follow the dollars, okay?
Yeah, always. Right, always, always, Jamala. And also, this, lesser known, but there were some small camps in Hawaii, and some of the leaders, really what they consider the largest threats in Hawaii of Japanese Americans, were actually shipped to the mainland to be incarcerated. But for the most part, I don't want to diminish the horror of the camps in Hawaii, but it was not, you know, like the mass incarceration that happened off the West Coast of the United States.
Well, if some people got to serve and they were treated as patriots, who were the ones who ended up in the camps?
Everybody. Well, no, in Hawaii, if you're speaking about Hawaii, people, the Japanese Americans, like most immigrants, they want just to work, raise their families, you know, seen as good people and good Americans. So many, many of the young people during the time of Pearl Harbor did sign up, and they were not originally allowed to enter the U.S. military, but went into, like, these reserve corps and that kind of thing. And out of these reserve corps, at a particular point in the war, the U.S. needed more soldiers. And so they were able to, you know, open it up and form out of Hawaii the 100th Battalion that joined. And then, can you picture this? Well, first of all, I want to point out the contradiction of saying that we're a national security threat, right?
We've heard that term before, haven't we?
Absolutely. And then they come to the U.S. concentration camps, and, you know, they say, well, you know, we'd like to have you voluntarily, you know, join the military. And because they didn't get a big response, you can imagine, you know, they're behind barbed wire, they're not going to just volunteer. They did the draft. And then through volunteers and draft, that's when the JA, very famous battalion, the 442 RCT, was created, and they served so heroically in Europe while their parents and families were behind barbed wire in the United States.
Well, that's such a contradiction, but there were 300 who refused the draft, you know, and, you know, and they got charged with draft resistance, and that was upheld until they were pardoned by President Truman. So, you know, so it just, I mean, we see this happening in many communities, in racial groups. There's some who, you know, going to go this way and some who's going to go that way. But I was really proud of the 300, because, I mean, the contradiction of, you want me to go fight in your war, and I'm sitting up here looking at barbed wire, you got to be crazy.
Right. Yes, what happened was that when the war broke out, you know, there were many Japanese Americans, disproportionate number of Japanese Americans who were involved in union organizing and in the left movement. You know, and what happened was that, you know, many people felt that even though they're, you know, had their own union struggles and fighting against, you know, Roosevelt and some of his policies, that Hitler and fascism was the main danger.
Right.
It's more dangerous. So they voluntarily joined the army and went and fought in Europe. Many people did. Mm. However, with Japanese, you know, many of the people who said, well, wait a minute. Yeah, well, Hitler's a big danger, but you're locking me up in camp.
Right.
Like my family, just like you said, Jamala. And so, you know, this group of people came like the largest group of who had tried mass trial in U.S. history, the resistors. And they said that, you know, we're not afraid to go fight. We're not afraid to defend democracy, but it's our democracy that you are taking away.
Mm.
And until that's resolved, we can't be, you know, going off to go die for you.
Right.
You know?
And it sounds so similar to what was going on with the Double V campaign.
Exactly.
You know, we're going to go to your war, but you better treat us right when we go back home. So we're fighting on two fronts, the enemy front and then at home front.
You know, and everything else. You
right,
know?
Right.
Yeah, let me toss in that all those valiant people that joined the military during World War II, people of color, they were in segregated units.
Right.
Oh, yeah. 442 was all Japanese.
Exactly.
And the black units, and the Mexican units, and the Navajo. You know, it was just all segregated. And one of my relatives who served in the 442 said that even when Roosevelt came to one of the camps, training camps, like Camp Shelby in the South, that all the Asians, all the Japanese guys were herded into one particular barrack and were not allowed to be present, not allowed to be seen.
Mm.
You know, so it's ridiculous. I mean, just one more huge.
They used to always talk about, you know what, man, I'm going into the white only. I'm not going into the white only bathroom. I'm going to go into the black one, you know? It was like the Japanese were like, well, which bathroom do we go to, you know?
Wow. So I think when folks are trying to understand what it means to be snatched from your home with very little notice and say only bring what you need, and you're leaving communities that you have served, that you have businesses there, you have friends and family there. And I remember, I don't know whether it was Yuri Yoshiyama's biography. Yeah, but when she wrote and said that when they were taken away and she looked at the faces of her neighbors, who obviously were white, and they had such contempt, and she couldn't figure out, wait a minute, we've been in this neighborhood for forever, and all of a sudden that you switched on us. Like, so I can't imagine like what that, I can't even imagine what that felt like. But here's the thing, people left behind businesses, homes, some of which were paid for, to be shipped away. Some places, they end up actually staying wherever they were. They didn't all come back to California. But I'm wondering, this set up the basis for really the redress and reparations movement. Because I'm thinking, okay, you all have taken these folks' property. You know, you've taken just about everything, dignity. I mean, some of this you can't even quantify. What were, and when did people really start thinking about reparations? Was it around the time in the 80s when they did the committee to get the stories out, and people were like, wow, we lost all of this. We deserve something here. What's going on here?
You know, I have to say right now that it was a civil rights movement. This is when we learned.
Okay.
We joined everyone and began to learn. And so, you know, in NCRR and progressive groups, we always give credit to especially the black leaders who led the civil rights movement, because we learned from them. And we, some people even said, without the civil rights movement, we would not have had redress and reparations, or it may have taken a lot longer or been different. But because especially the third generation, David and I are, well, David, I'm sorry, your second generation or your first generation?
Yeah,
I'm third here. We were able to go through American, you know, schools and most of us, a lot of us college, and during the 60s. What a gift to have grown up and gone to college during the 60s and learned so much. I think that was a huge, huge element the civil rights movement. And but then, different, you know, I think the young leaders in Little Tokyo, especially the people I related to, realized that it was time. It was time, and some people like Edison Uno did make a call. He was a well-known Japanese-American for reparations in the 70s. But the momentum was a little slow at that time. But by the 80s and those commission hearings that you referenced to, that just sparked the whole movement. And there was no denying it because, you know, like what David shared about families never talking about, you know, camp, absolutely true. And so for us to learn all of this, it really just, yeah, really literally blew our minds. And, you know, but I do want to just pivot back to the financial losses you referenced, mm-hmm, Jamala.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
One thing that, you know, we all keep learning about history, and as we learn more, things change. You know, our perspectives change because it's a very living thing. One of the things since the redress movement that I've learned from people like Professor Richard Miller is that there was a 20 to 30 years before the camps, California Republican right-wing legislators were really lobbying hard Franklin Roosevelt during the New Deal period, mm-hmm, to get rid of the Japanese, to do something, because the big agriculture, which was just beginning to start, at the mechanization of agriculture was happening in California. And these people, the bankers and everybody represented, they lobbied Roosevelt to find a way to get rid of the Japanese, and moreover, so that they don't come back to their farms. Their farms, by 1938, Japanese farms accounted for three-quarters of all table vegetables sold in the United States. The flour industry, which today is like an internationally coveted industry, was begun by the Japanese.
Wow.
Their orchards, Japanese orchards, because of the skill level that they brought from Japan as farmers, they outvalued American farms per acre by like quadruple, maybe 10 times the worth. So they were a big impediment to the development of mechanization because they were not mechanized, the opposite, and they needed to be out of the way. So when the Pearl Harbor incident came up, that provided the perfect excuse to lock them all up and say it's national security, which is bullshit. We all know that.
Right.
Okay. However, when they took over all this property, it came out to almost the county of San Diego, the size of it. That's how large it was.
Wow.
It's, and you cannot even count it. They all wound up in the hands of large, you know, grocery food conglomerates, mm-hmm, banks. Mm-hmm. You know, that's where they wound up. But the entire thing was based on that. And even February was chosen because of the crop season, you know, so that it would not interfere in the case that they wanted to use the prisoners to, you know, help with the crop. They picked February. He also noted that all the staff that they chose for the concentration camps, the soldiers, the equipment, everything was like second-rate and reject, you know?
Mm.
However, the staff that they chose to carefully and copiously confiscate in detail all the property, they had the best staff available.
Of course.
The absolute tops. Mm. So he provides many, many, many detailed accounts, quantified, of how the ripoff occurred and why it was economically motivated just as much as it was politically.
Wow. Well, if you're just joining us, this is Jamala Rogers, host of Voices from the Battlefield, and we have two folks on the battlefield still, maybe not as active as they once were, but certainly they have a legacy, and that is David Mankawa and KOT. I mean, this, you know, we're talking about redress and reparations, and so when I think about, for example, I mean, what you just laid out, David, about the farms, and I know many of the Japanese Americans had to leave those farms when they were, you know, rounded up. But there were also, you know, they had money in the bank, and they froze the accounts. I mean, I just, all of this, the wealth is one thing. Is one thing, and some of it reminded me or sounded very similar to black land loss, where you know you think
exactly.
You think you had a farm and some acres,
exactly.
But you ain't
right.
Got nothing, and so and
right.
Then they used all of the systems to make sure you don't get it back, but there was also the whole notion of what could have happened. And so I was reading somewhere where it was estimated that probably the lost property was around $1.3 billion at that time, and lost wages was around $2.7 billion. So some of this stuff, as I said, couldn't be quantified. So how did we get to $20,000 per Japanese
individual?
Yeah.
One thing I just want to mention, I think Key might have accidentally dropped off.
Oh.
I don't know what could be done.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, so I can try to answer that question.
Yeah.
Well, the $20,000 was a somewhat arbitrary. First, it was like 50, then somebody said 25, but it was based on what people thought we might be able to win.
Sorry, y'all. I didn't know that was going to cut David off. So we're trying to get Kay back on.
Hi there.
Being that, you know, 20,000, that figure.
Wow.
David?
So, David, yes, can you repeat that? Because we actually, I was trying to get Kay back on the line. How did we get to 20,000 per individual?
Sure. Yeah, Jamal asked how we came up with 20,000. I said it was fairly, you know, it was based kind of like on what we thought we can win, but there was no real scientific basis for it. And maybe you'd like to add, Key?
No, you're right, David. And also, I believe that the commission, the federal commission, in their final report, also had suggested 25,000. And so it really, the 80s were a different time. It's like we certainly didn't get, you know, what we really deserved.
Mm-hmm.
Reparations, but we always say the 20,000 was a symbolic, a token of the government's admission.
And actually, it seems like to me, people of Japanese ancestry were saying the apology that came from California, and sometimes it came from the municipalities like San Diego about what had been done, was actually more heartfelt than the money. Do you think that's true, or is that some propaganda?
You know, a lot of people really felt the apology was more important because the government admitted a wrongdoing,
mm-hmm.
you know, and how many times has that happened in U.S. history?
Mm-hmm.
And also some of the older Japanese really took that to heart. I don't know if David mentioned, but all the elders who had passed away before 1988, August 10th, they were excluded. They did not receive any kind, their families did not receive any, you know, restitution. But the Department of Justice, upon request, would provide them with the apology letter, and they would take that, you know, and it was significant to them. So,
okay.
But there's a lot that the reparations did not accomplish.
So approximately how many people got the reparations, since they excluded a whole damn generation?
It was 82,250.
Okay.
That was, and you know, I think that it speaks well to our community. In 1990, after the bill was passed, the government had to scramble and figure out how to pay, you know, all these reparations. Their actuarials, their statisticians said, oh, there's 60,000 still alive. Mm-hmm. So actually, the government really only wanted to, you know, put aside, or actually through Daniel Inoue, the senator from Hawaii, through his work, you know, got the funding, but it was very limited. And so they actually did run out of money.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to pass another bill. You know, it was a lot of scrambling to get this
done. And a lot of keeping the pressure on, because if you all didn't keep the pressure on, they were like, hey, we ran out of money. That's the end of that.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
What happened was a big, big victory for the Republicans Ronald Reagan got in 1980. And immediately cut corporate taxes and created a fake deficit so that, you know, not as much money come into the federal coffers. And therefore, that was reused as the reason to delay redress or anything for years. For years, we were told by some of these legislators, oh, you know, federal deficit, money's tight, nobody's getting nothing right now, you know? And so it's not a good time to bring this up.
Oh, it's never a good time to bring this
up. Right. So in my opinion, every day that they delayed, five people died who could have got redress. So in my opinion, those days of delay, they owe us another probably a billion or so.
Right. So there were approximately 120,000 folks that ended up in the camps, and some of those, because they had died, did not get anything nor their families. Mm-hmm. So, and I know most of those were from California. Were there concentrations of Japanese American anywhere else in the country at that time?
Well, it's California,
Hawaii,
Oregon, Oregon, and Seattle. Washington State, the entire West Coast, and so there was a very vibrant Japanese American community up in Seattle that I'm aware of. But the masses were on the West Coast.
Okay.
But I think the point is that one of the impacts of the wartime incarceration was a diaspora. They wanted to break up the economic strength of Japanese hardworking immigrants and who had really, you know, worked the sandy soil of the beaches to make them successful farms. Mm. All that got lost to them.
Mm.
And so I think that the diaspora, there are, you know, very strong communities now in Chicago, even New York, because people could not necessarily go back to the West Coast.
Exactly. And even in the South, sometimes you come across, you know, Asian with a drawl, and you're like, where did that come from?
Right.
They were located in Georgia somewhere, and then they just stayed.
Sure.
Yeah.
Right.
So
the whole assimilation, Americanization program began with the loyalty oaths, but they ended up with resettlement program, and when they were let go, they were told three things. Don't speak Japanese. Do not concentrate in big communities, especially on the West Coast, and keep your head low.
Wow.
They were given a pamphlet that said, when you get out of camp, and that was it. And then they had to report, wherever they were at, they had to report to the local WRA office. There were about 35 of them. They had to report to the office whenever they moved around.
Wow.
This is after the camps.
Wow.
This is after the camps.
So, in fact, they were on some kind of probation, almost like having a damn monitor on their legs, okay?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea was to completely, like Kay said, to completely disperse the community and to completely neutralize their minds so that they no longer thought in terms of rising up against anything.
Right, right. And perhaps that also contributed to the silence that you all alluded to. I mean, if you were told
Absolutely.
Why would you jeopardize yourself and your family by even talking about it? Wow.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely.
And not to even mention the hostilities all over the country about, you know, the war with Japan.
Yeah.
And what you referenced earlier in our conversation, Jamala, was about Americans, the broader white community, the majority, not understanding that people of color are Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And I really bristle when people reference white folks as, you know, the Americans did it or something.
Mm-hmm.
No. Let's clean up our language.
That's totally twisted, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. And so I do want to say that there are so many contradictions. The more, you know, one learns about it, I would hope that your listeners have lots of questions.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we're blessed with Google, you can find out all about the 100-442 and how much blood was shed by those, you know, fine people in order to, you know, serve their country and prove their citizenship or their loyalty. I mean, there's such tragic stories. And I did want to just also mention about the trauma, the kind of the generational trauma that even our young people, our fourth generation and fifth generation, are thinking about, experiencing and talking about. What the U.S. government did in 41 is rippled, in 42 with EO9066, through many generations. And I believe it's because the trauma is internalized.
Right.
And it's shared through generations.
Mm-hmm. And but not only that, trauma of folks of African descent, it continues. It's on a daily basis. So it's not going anywhere, and it's just re-traumatizing on a daily basis.
Exactly. Scientifically, scientists have already proven that certain traumatic experiences they get transferred through DNA.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. We just had a conversation about this yesterday. Exactly.
No, it's really true, because they're saying that, look, it's scientific, because you know how fish and birds, why is it that they can find where to go and roost and have kids when they didn't even have any idea what the pattern was.
Wow.
Yes, they don't know.
Absolutely.
Okay?
Absolutely.
And they for a long time, they didn't know. They said it was instinct.
Mm-hmm.
But now recently they found out, no, it's not instinct. It's chromosomes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's passed through.
Mm-hmm.
Knowledge is passed through generations.
Wow. So the question of redress and reparations, in Japan itself, and this was particularly after the atomic bomb was dropped, there was this whole thing of, you know, forgiveness for the Americans for whatever that was worth. Was there a similar thing that happened during the redress movement in this country, like trying to hook up with those racist folks who, you know, were complicit to the camps and all the other horrors that came with it, to really try to say, okay, let's have some truth and reconciliation here? Any attempts to do that, or any interest in doing that?
Well, the right wing really fought against it. People like S.I. Hayakawa, Lillian Baker. S.I. Hayakawa was the highest ranking U.S. senator of Japanese American descent, I mean Canadian descent. Uh-huh. So it's a pretty tough enemy to have a senator against you, you know? So yes, the right wing really fought hard. The races all came out of the woodwork.
And, but, you know, kind of to expand that question, the only national organization that the Japanese American community had was the JACL. And the JACL is a very, very controversial organization because back in the 40s, you have to remember that the U.S. government, right after Pearl Harbor, whisked away all the elder leaders of the community. So what you had trying to lead a community faced with this removal and incarceration were a younger group of men. They all voted to be accommodationists. But they said the best thing for our people to do is to go along with what the government wants, and therefore that'll show our loyalty. So that's why our younger folks are wondering, why did you go off to camps led like lambs to the slaughter? Mm. You know. Mm. So there's a lot of, you've got to really, I think education and learning and reading is so important for all of us. But the JACL created so many divisions in our community because of that kind of very conservative, very narrow.
What was that acronym about, Kate?
Which acronym?
JACL.
So people know.
Oh, Japanese American Citizens League. Thank you, David. Mm-hmm. They exist today, and they're very strong. We have offices all over the, you know, communities and where there are Japanese populations, et cetera. They still are a national organization, but the good news is that with time and a change of leadership and with education and their own learning, they're much more progressive. They come out with very, very good stands in the state. Mm-hmm. But pivoting back, they created such chaos in our community that to this day, if there are any elders alive, there are many who either hate the JACL because of their wartime record, and if there are any resistors still with us, they despise the JACL because the JACL cast them as traitors and, you know, the worst of the worst.
Mm-hmm.
Those kinds of labels stuck with the resistors of conscience for their entire lives.
Wow.
The JACL would be more like, you know, as Malcolm would say, those Negroes inside the house.
Uh-huh, the house Negroes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I was thinking that when she was described, I'm like, I recognize that characterization. Mm-hmm. In the few minutes that we have left, I want us to talk about the atomic bomb because that commemoration is coming up. And there are some things that will be happening, I'm sure, locally and nationally. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were in many, now that we have some space from that, many folks and observers and researchers and historians will say that the bombing was unnecessary. The Japanese had pretty much already surrendered. But the U.S. government had spent so much time and money on this experiment that they needed to see how it worked. And so they dropped the bomb anyway, knowing that there was an imminent, surrender. So that has to have colored the whole way that this thing fell out. But just thinking about what the damage that was done, I mean, literally, and if you ever see some of the, documentaries and they describe what happens when these bombs hit a body. I mean, it pulverizes like bone.
It liquefies
you. So, so they were able to see the impact of all their good work that they had done, and to use it on a country of color, to me is just like, you know, insidious. But we are going to be remembering those survivors and remembering the whole way that we use weapons against human beings, particularly nuclear weapons. So I just want us to talk about what has been the movement around those bombings, and what can we expect for the commemoration, and what should we be celebrating or not celebrating when we go into these spaces?
Well, you're absolutely right about the fact that the bomb was not necessary. There are many official sources that already admit that. One of the earliest being the 1946 strategic bombing survey by the U.S. War Department, which conclusively said that, you know, it was not necessary. They were already going to surrender. Eisenhower also said the same thing. And the U.S. Department of Energy's website actually says that. So that's pretty official. Mm. However, you have a movie like Best Movie of the Year, Oppenheimer.
Mm.
In that movie, they repeat the falsity that it was necessary to drop the bomb.
Right.
You know?
Well, the other thing that they do in that movie, David, is they say that the testing area was no population, and I had some folks from the downwinders come on the show to defeat that notion. So, yeah, it's just lies, lies, and more lies.
Right. The real reason, and Eisenhower also said this, is to scare Russia. Because when they were fighting against the Japanese fascists and the Russians joined in, Stalin was going to invade Japan at the last minute and take it over. And the U.S. said, hey, wait a minute, you know what? We got a bomb now. We don't need your ass over here. Why don't you just chill out and we'll take care of this? Okay? And so they wanted Japan. They didn't want Stalin to be going in there. Says, you know, this is ours, so you just chill out. We got this. We got this. So they dropped the bomb and said, you all watch this, because in the next world order, we're going to be ruling. See, because the British no longer was major anymore.
Right.
That's one of the outcomes of World War II. It says, we're going to be top dog, and we're going to run things the way we want to run things. And if you all want to come against us, here's what you're going to face. Then they drop two bombs.
Mm.
And after that, everybody said, okay, we understand now.
Yeah, we got the message.
That's how, and that's how the world has been run since that time, even now. And to your point about what they're going to commemorate in Japan this year, we'll be commemorating... what they're going to commemorate is the fact that it did not have to be dropped, and that the Japanese government right now, which basically they're clones of the U.S. government, okay, the clones of the U.S. government, they're going to be pushing for building nuclear weapons to attack China. And so that's what they're going to be. That's what the Japanese peace movement, you know, in the Hiroshima Nagasaki Committee will be concentrating on this year, to stop the future nuclear wars from happening.
Wow. And you also
I was going to add that I've always wondered why they dropped a bomb on civilian populations. You know, isn't that against everything, you know, of rules of war, if there are any such things, a complete civilian population, and that Japan does not call out the U.S. as having perpetrated one of the most unnecessary, heinous acts of all human history.
Yeah.
It's like Japan is just so, you know, wanting to appease and forget. I don't know if how could they forget, but they let U.S. Get away with it, and it's not brought up.
Yeah. Wow. Certain of the right wingers are like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, not the peace movement, but
not at all.
And Kay, you had an event that's coming up in your area.
Right, in Los Angeles, a very active, called the American Society of Hiroshima and Nagasaki A-Bomb Survivors, ASA. They're having the 79th annual commemoration service for A-bomb victims and survivors. And it's going to be held at one of our temples in downtown Los Angeles, the Koyasan Temple at 342 First Street, for those who may be in the area. But they've conducted these annual commemorations. And what it does is it keeps it, very importantly, in the minds of you know, everyone, and that the damage still continues, and the doctors do still come over and test the survivors who are in the United States for the, you know, for their medical situations, even 79 years later. It's all an important part of our history.
And so what's interesting to me when you talked about, I thought you were getting ready to talk about when you said why they had to bomb civilians, because that seemed to be so anti-war rules. But my question is, they dropped the bomb on the 6th. They saw the damage, and then they turned around 3 days later and drop another right. one. I mean, okay, you saw the devastation. You saw the human suffering. Now you got to do it twice? I mean, to me, you're talking about going before the tribunal, world tribunal for criminals. I mean, really, total war criminals. And most people think that was more deserving of reparations than the concentration camps, but there was nothing forthcoming for that.
Yeah, because it was the war, you know, considered part of the war. But you're right, though. There should be reparations, but, you know, that didn't transpire. I mean, you're talking 200,000 lives in 5 minutes.
Mm, mm.
5 minutes.
Right, right. I mean, it's amazing. You really have to hear it described if you can stand it, like what that kind of nuclear reaction does to a human body. And just think about what it does to babies and children if it does that to adults.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
I think it's important to really reflect upon the fact that this moment in history right now, 2024, we're coming up on an election. Very, very, very important that people get out and do what they need to do to vote.
Yeah,
that
absolutely.
We don't get closer to that atomic clock going off.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very, very precarious, scary time in our lives.
Yeah.
So we all have to step up and do what we have to do.
Yeah, we need to
absolutely
stay
correct.
Woke
yep.
and involved and engaged.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Regardless of what you think about the Democrats, we don't want certain people to be holding the red button.
Tell me about
That's for
it.
Sure.
Tell me about
for
sure. it. David Mankawa and KOT, thank you for joining us today and educating us. I mean, it was definitely a history lesson. And for folks who need to hear this again, and we definitely want to, for folks who missed it, you can always get past radio shows on JamalaRogers.com. The links are all there. This will be there as well. Thank you for joining us and sharing these incredible stories with us.
Thank you for having us here today. Thank you, Jamala.
Okay. So before we end, we want to say welcome home, Christopher Dunn. He got out yesterday after serving 33 years of wrongful incarceration. And so we're shouting out to him, his family. He's got reconnected last night. What a day that was yesterday. So, and we are getting closer to the commemoration of the murder of Mike Brown by Ferguson police and the ensuing Ferguson uprising. So there's lots of activities around that, you all. I can't even begin to give you all of those. You'd probably just have to go to the newspapers or, you know, go online to see what's happening. But I do know that Michelle Martin of NPR is going to be in town, and she's going to be holding her show at the Greater St. Mark Family Church. And if you all don't remember that, that's where we had a lot of all the gatherings during Ferguson uprising. So they're going to return to that scene. So if you can make that tonight at 7, but they will be doing those conversations ongoing in other ways. So yeah, check that out. And then on the 8th, the Homer G. Phillips Nurses Association, who have been fighting valiantly against the use of their name on that piece of trash over there on Northside called Homer G. Phillips Memorial Facility, they're going to be going to court on the 8th in St. Louis County Court at 9 a.m., so they're going to need our support there. There is a lot going on, y'all. We have, for example, Ferguson is America, Roots of Rebellion. It's being sold by the Youth Council for Positive Development. That's one of their fundraisers that has been reissued. So you can go to the website, and I'll have all of that on the website. And there's also a Ferguson survey. If you want to talk about what that meant to you, where you were, what you were doing, what you believe we got, what we didn't get, all of that we want to hear from you. So thank you for listening. This is Jamala, your host, and I will see you on the battlefield.